Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg on this July 9th.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And it's nice to be back. New week.
Yes.
We have a big show today, Cherry.
Yes.
Headlined by a big question.
And the big question is, who should be held responsible for kids' bad online behavior? Should it be parents? Should it be the children themselves? Should it be the government, social media companies? And then what should be done? What is the proper punishment? We want to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And of course, Avi, all of this came from a big story in the New York Times that broke over the weekend.
It was one of those stories where it came out over the weekend.
Yep.
And like multiple people are sending it to you. Mm-hmm. Like Joan Isabella, our audio general manager, sent
it
us
worked.
All a text.
Yeah.
Like, did you see this? And, you know, I'm getting that from multiple people because it was such a shocking story.
It was.
It takes place at a middle school in Chester County where teenagers at the school, 7th and 8th graders, mm-hmm. created fake TikTok accounts impersonating their teachers, over 20 of their teachers. And these accounts, claiming to be the teachers themselves, spewed all sorts of hateful stuff, bigoted stuff, stuff suggesting the teachers were pedophiles.
Yeah.
And of course, that got everyone's attention in the community. And then the New York Times wrote about it and it became a national story because the reporter who covered it, who we're going to talk to later in the story, is a veteran mm-hmm. reporter. And she said she'd never seen like a coordinated TikTok attack like this before.
Yeah, said it was the largest mass attack on teachers like this of its kind that she's ever seen. So we'll be joined by Natasha Sanger, who broke the story. We also have the superintendent of the school district. We have the teachers union president there. And we'll also hear from a professor of neurology from Penn to talk about, are kids getting meaner thanks to social media? A lot of questions.
And again, the big question is, really, who should be held responsible? Yeah. Like, what should happen in a case like this? Should the kids be punished solely? Should the parents mm-hmm. be held responsible somehow? Should there be laws? Should the government intervene? Should the social media companies be a more active presence in this case, in this space? So email us, studio2@whyy.org. We want your reaction to that big question this hour. And again, the number is 888-477-9499. That's WHYY.
And we have some news.
Yeah, some news this morning. Mm-hmm. Big local story this morning. Oh, this is juicy. Pennsylvania, Cherry.
Uh-huh, drum roll.
Drum roll. Is getting new license plates.
Womp womp. Yay.
No,
that's
wait,
good.
Womp womp. Okay.
That's good, though.
Okay,
that's
we know where
womp,
you stand.
That's a higher pitch.
Oh, got
womp,
it. It's a positive womp womp. I didn't know that existed. It's an interesting wrinkle. We learned about this from PennDOT and from Governor Josh Shapiro this mm-hmm. morning. These are going to be rolled out starting next year, and they are to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the United States the year after that, 2026. Very hard to do visuals on the radio. But allow me to try to describe how the new license mm-hmm. plate will look. So you know that they've had the blue and yellow color scheme for a long, long time.
That's gone.
That's out. This is now going to be like a cream-colored background with red and blue lettering.
Actually white, yes.
There will be like a Liberty Bell shadow image mm-hmm. behind the license number itself. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom, it says, "Let Freedom Ring." Mm. You know, Liberty Bell, Let Freedom Ring. Your reaction, and by the way, this is a whole rebranding. They're going to have new state welcome signs on the roads. This is Pennsylvania is getting a whole facelift here.
Yeah.
Let Freedom Ring.
I realize that phrase comes from My Country, 'Tis of Thee, but mm-hmm. whenever I hear it, my Dr. Martin Luther King voice activates. You know, let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania.
There's Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. That's what I think of. And I was just kind of, I mean, I'm excited mm-hmm. in the sense that we get something new to put on our cars in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And I'll probably lean all the way in on this. At the same time, I mean, it was kind of like,
oh, it didn't connect with you.
It didn't really connect with me, especially the let freedom ring part. It just didn't feel Pennsylvania. But you know what?
But it's the Liberty Bell.
I give
Bell.
The government. The government's trying to get people excited about Pennsylvania. You know, 250th. You know, he's trying.
Okay. He's trying.
Yeah.
That's the best you could
That's
say.
That's all I got.
He's trying.
Mm-hmm.
I will say it's a bit of a cultural triumph for Eastern Pennsylvania to have the Liberty Bell so prominent and let
it
freedom
is.
Ring.
That is true.
And the bell has been on it, on the license plate before in sort of smaller, mm-hmm. in smaller relief. But this is like a big Yeah, Liberty Bell.
The bell is it. Yeah.
The bell is it. And I would say Eastern Pennsylvania is it. Sorry, Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Eastern PA. Lit. There you go.
Rise up.
You rise up. And, you know, this is a story that has sort of been percolating for the past several days, Avi.
We're moving on from license plates.
Yeah, we're moving on from license plates. WURD President and CEO Sarah Lomax Reese was on air, and I heard her interview. She called out the campaign of President Joe Biden. She said that they were trying to pull a fast one after the station aired an interview with the president with a now former WURD host.
Now okay, rewind.
I'm a rewind. I'm going to back it up. Yeah. In case you didn't know, WURD is an independent black-owned media station here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. The host in question is Andrea Lawful Sanders, who, to be totally transparent, is someone I've known for years and have a lot of respect for. She apparently got a call from the Biden administration or campaign, let me clarify, offering the interview with the president on her show, which was called The Source. She recorded that interview with President Biden on Zoom. WURD aired that interview on July 4th.
So far, sounds normal.
Sounds normal, yeah. Over the weekend, Lawful Sanders told CNN that the four questions she asked during the interview were sent to her from the Biden campaign and that she approved them.
So the campaign, she asked questions that the campaign had provided.
Yes. I mean, she approved of them. Now, she did say she approved of them and they went back and forth. So the fact of the supply questions, of course, went viral, Avi, because many Democrats have been asking whether the president can do the job following the debate debacle.
Right.
All right. WURD, they issued a statement saying it was not consulted during the interview prep process, and Andrea Lawful Sanders has since resigned from the station. Now, again, I've known Andrea for years. I met her during her work as a trusted education consultant. She is loved by the community. Hundreds of people have posted or sent words of support. But it begs the question, would the Biden campaign have done this to CBS? Would they have done that to NBC, to NPR,
is sending the questions.
Suggesting questions. Or the WHYY and Sarah Lomax Reese, the owner of WID, says she doesn't think so. She believes they tried to pull a fast one.
They targeted WURD in this
that's
case.
That's the implied thought there.
Okay. And then what was also interesting is that this now former WURD radio host said in response that she is not a journalist, does not consider herself a journalist.
And that the station knew that when they hired her as an independent contractor. Exactly.
So what do you make of that then? It's sort of a defense, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not a journalist. And so for me, your journalistic ethics, your rules, your code, I'm not familiar with it and it doesn't really apply to what I do. That's what I took from that.
Well, and in all fairness, many of the hosts on WURD are not trained journalists. They do have some people who are, but not everybody is. They were held to the standard of journalists. We have a transparency rule, right? Part of our code, act independently rule, which means we don't necessarily read questions from a campaign, but not everybody who's on air. Some people are influencers. Some people are celebrities.
Well,
some people are
more,
a lot of things,
more and more.
And so the question is, like, when you have non-journalists sitting in the seat of that journalists used to occupy, right? Should they be held to the same standard? Should we just know that they're not necessarily held to the same standard?
Oh, I think it's pretty confusing for the audience, too, because I can't imagine they really distinguish between someone who considers themselves a journalist and someone who doesn't. They're just looking at this person as the interlocutor, as the interviewer of the president or of the celebrity or of whoever it is. It's a very confusing world, I think, for readers and listeners and viewers.
Yeah. And by the way, Andrea has integrity. People, again, love her. And she's been moderating town halls. She's interviewed politicians all the time. So to her, she acted with integrity. Mm-hmm. But it asks the question, are all these organizations journalistic organizations or not? So there you go.
Well, I think that does it for this segment. We want to transition now to talk again about our big question today that we're going to talk about for the rest of the program. And that's, you know, who should be held accountable when young people, in this case, we're talking about 7th and 8th graders, misbehave online, target adults, say things that are defamatory, things that clearly cross a line in the adult world, but they are themselves children. Yeah. And this is all based on an incident that happened in Chester County that the New York Times covered. We're going to talk with the New York Times reporter who broke the story. We'll tell you all about it coming after the break. But that's the big question today. Who should be held accountable? Is it punishment for the kids, for the parents? Should there be laws? Should the government intervene? Should law enforcement be involved? Should the school district be more involved?
Should social tech companies? Yeah.
There's a lot of people here who could be the interveners, but this is a new world, right? And we don't exactly know who's responsible. So we want to hear from you. Studio2@WHYY.org is the email address. Our number is 888-477-WHYY. We will be right back on Studio 2.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You may have read about students at Great Valley Middle School who created fake teacher TikTok accounts. The accounts impersonating teachers were shared among students across the school community and included racist, homophobic, and sexually explicit content, the type of comments and memes that could be career-ending for a teacher.
This scandal has become national news after New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer broke the story over the weekend. She's going to join us later this hour to talk about what happened and the broader concerns that this case highlights. We also expect to be joined later by the Great Valley School District superintendent, the local teachers union president, and an expert on the teenage brain.
And now, the question to you, our listeners, this hour is, who should be held responsible when kids behave badly online? Should it be the parents? Should it be tech companies? Should it be the children themselves? And Matthew emails us. He says online behavior and offline behavior need to be treated alike. Responsibility for kids lie on the community, parents, and schools. Not a simple solution, unfortunately. We want you to weigh in. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Again, the question is, who should be held responsible when kids behave badly online?
Right now, let's bring in reporter Natasha Singer. She's a technology reporter for the New York Times who covers education, and she broke this whole story surrounding Great Valley Middle School. Natasha, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with what happened and have you walk us through this. So what's the timeline here? When were these accounts created and who was creating them? What do we know?
We know that in February, teachers first heard that students at Great Valley Middle School had created these imposter accounts about them. And they began looking toward the end of February, and they discovered that kids in the middle school had set up impersonation accounts that disparaged and trolled and in some cases slandered their teachers, using their teachers' full names with photos of the teachers scraped from the school faculty website, or they had copied photos that teachers had posted in their classrooms of the teachers' families. And so the, you know, profiles on TikTok of these fake accounts were, you know, looked like the real teachers. Then the fake teachers posted a string of videos and comments that were rife with pedophilia innuendo, racist remarks, homophobic comments, and made up sexual relationships among teachers.
And so just to clarify, like if you were to go on TikTok, you might see an account that was claimed to be Fred Smith, middle school teacher at this school, and it would be Fred Smith's picture, and it would even be maybe Fred Smith's wife and Fred Smith's kids. So it looked like the person, but what they were saying was reprehensible on the social media platform.
Right. And not only was it Fred Smith, it was Fred Smith, math teacher at Great Valley Middle, with an email address often that used the school district domain. So it might have like a few typos in the name, but it looked in certain cases like it was the official contact info. And yes, then with reprehensible videos and comments that were completely unteacher-like, and in some cases made the kind of accusations that could get teachers fired if they had been true.
Wow. And Natasha, your article says that what these 7th and 8th graders at Great Valley Middle School did is sort of like the first known mass attack of its kind. Can you explain and help us understand the scope of how many people were involved and how many people were touched by this?
Thank you for asking that, because we chose the language group attack very carefully. You know, I've been a journalist covering technology in schools for more than a decade, and we know that students, teens, children have impersonated their teachers and their principals and their superintendents online for two decades. In fact, one of the first cases, one of the first lawsuits about this was from a student in 2005 at Hickory High School in Hermitage, Pennsylvania, who used his grandmother's computer to make a fake MySpace profile. You know, MySpace is a now defunct social media platform of his teacher. That was in 2005, right? And so we wouldn't have done this if this was just one student impersonating one teacher. But what happened here was you had a number of students, was it half a dozen, was it a dozen, impersonating more than 20 teachers, which is about a quarter of the teaching staff at the school. And so in my experience as a journalist, I had never seen students impersonating 25% of their teachers at one school, right? So that the unusual scale of it was what made it a story, but also the intricateness of it, because the students each set up fake accounts of a teacher, and sometimes a student might set up several fake accounts of a teacher, but then the fake teachers followed other fake teachers, and the fake teachers followed dozens of students, and dozens of students followed the fake teachers. And so the fake teachers were then commenting on the fake teachers' accounts, saying things about their sexual relationships or making pedophilic comments, and students were commenting on the teachers. And in addition to the students, you know, dozens of students following the fake teachers, hundreds of students viewed these videos. And so it became a group middle school-wide, or at least 7th and 8th grade-wide attack on these teachers.
I want to read in this email now from Beth, who says, I am a proud parent of two wonderful tweens who attend GVMS. That's the acronym for the middle school we're talking about. And Beth wants us all to remember that the actions of a few are not representative of the whole. We talk about technology use in our house, and I shared select details about the cyberbullying of the teachers so we can learn from this situation. My kids are as disturbed by these acts as I am, and I want all the teachers there to know how much we appreciate them. So that's Beth's comment. Do we know how many students were participating in this? And this is the bigger question that's probably harder to answer. Do we understand why they would do something like this?
So there are around 1,100 students at Great Valley Middle School, and certainly many did not participate. And certainly many probably thought it was horrible. So it was not the entire school. But you know, I have seen dozens of videos and hundreds of screen grabs from these accounts, and some of them were viewed several thousand times. And you can see that, say, more than 100 students at the school followed the accounts, and hundreds of kids saw these videos. So, you know, you could say that a very small group was actively involved in making these videos and accounts and pretending to be the teachers and attacking teachers.
Right.
But there were a lot of onlookers who did not initially tell their teachers or the school.
Right. And they sanctioned it in the sense that they participated in the world that these other students had built online, this fake world, this imposter world. And you're saying hundreds of students, perhaps, were at least aware of it and in some way interacting with it.
But also, you know, I interviewed 7 teachers at Great Valley Middle School. And according to their descriptions, you know, these accounts may have been created outside of school. But then as more students followed, they began talking about it during class, in the hallways. It disrupted study hall, in the libraries, in the lunchroom, very loudly in front of teachers. I heard so-and-so's husband left her for a man, right? Like, like really invasive comments. Like, it to teachers, it somehow you know, the way you're anonymous online and you can say hurtful things then came into the classroom, and some kids seem to be deliberately hurtful to their teachers. And so, again, when we talk about what is the scale of this, mm-hmm. it devastated the teaching ranks of this school.
Yeah, and I want to bring in Nikki Salvatico, president of the local Great Valley School District Teachers Union, into this conversation, Natasha, to hear from a teacher's perspective. Nikki, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I hope you were listening to Natasha Sanger, the technology reporter for the New York Times, that broke this story. I want you to sort of give a reaction. What has it been like for the teachers at the middle school, you know, during this time when they discovered all this massive group of fake accounts?
Well, it's definitely been traumatic and disheartening, because as teachers, we're vested in our students. And I can't speak for them personally because it didn't happen to me. But I know all of us as colleagues, you know, have been supporting them in solidarity to just share, like, what we would feel like, you know, when you put your whole life into teaching, right? Mm-hmm. And you're making a difference in other people's lives. And then you want to see them become successful and make good choices and have integrity. Like, in my classroom, every day we recite how we are confident, we are leaders, and we have integrity even when no one is looking. And that is what we want our kids to have. So when we see that going awry, it's concerning. But when it becomes an attack on yourself, the vulnerability that you have in the classroom, then it becomes an unsafe place for everyone.
Yeah.
Because this isn't just about the teachers. And I heard Natasha speaking, it's about the students as well. And I'm not talking about the few. I'm talking about everyone. I mean, everyone in this is a stakeholder. And we all have an obligation to raising successful contributors to society. And yeah. So when that is not happening, or there's a, let's just say, let's call this a little bit of a off-road path mm-hmm. that they're taking, we want to bring them back on the road, right? And we need the means to do that.
And what are the means that you need? What are the means that you need? Because we haven't really talked about this yet with Natasha, but the question around punishment and what should be done now, and what should be done that doesn't, you know, further exclude these students, push them further away, but brings them back onto that right path that you mentioned. What do you think should be done?
So everything's about knowledge, right?
Yeah.
When you have the appropriate knowledge to use the tools that you're given, you're going to make good choices. You're going to be successful. You're going, you know, might make a mistake, but learn from the mistake. So, you know, it's like when you have a toddler, you're not going to hand them a sharp knife to eat their food with. You're going to gradually move them into utensils that are appropriate and safe for them. It's the same with technology. And what the appropriate means to do this, for, in my opinion, is to have a digital citizenship program K-12, where everyone is invested, teachers, parents, students, and we're continually building that toolbox of successful strategies on how to use appropriate technology appropriately to create that safe learning environment. And there's also then the level that goes with policy and legislation. And that's what I know Natasha and I spoke about, and I'm so grateful for what she's doing, because I really do feel, and I know because my representative, Christine Howard's office, called me last night. We've been in touch before, and they're working on this, right? And we need to get there. We need to get there to make sure that there are policies and legislation that supports and keeps everyone in this environment safe, because as a former principal of mine said, none of us are immune from any of this.
Yeah.
So right now it's here. Where is it going to be next? And, you know, the fear is for us as teachers as well, kids attacking kids.
Yeah, so, of course. Can I ask you before we let you go, though, because we have an email here from Christine, one of our listeners, who says, I think that if these kids were slick enough to do this, they should be expelled and somehow they need to apologize publicly. Do you agree with that? Is expulsion the answer here? Do we need to make an example? Because these are 7th and 8th graders. These are young kids. I mean, do we need to make an example of them in that way? Or would you propose an alternative form of punishment?
So I'm the educator, right? Yeah. You know, I'm a parent. I have grandchildren. And that's honestly our administration. That's their job to do. You know, that's where I'm. This is bigger than the classroom, mm-hmm. so I don't really feel comfortable responding to that in that sense. But I will tell you, as an educator, I'll repeat what I said. It's all about what we need to know and what we need to teach our children and educate our community to be, one, it, you know, supporting, navigating this social media avalanche, basically. Yeah. It's coming faster and faster, and we aren't even close to keeping up with it. So we don't even know what we don't know, right? But what we're finding out through this is we need to respond positively with the proper tools for these kids to understand and be thinking and have the integrity and build that responsive classroom that says, even when no one is looking, I'm thinking in my head, is this the right choice or the wrong choice? Yeah. Where is it going to take us?
And thank you so much for being on Studio 2. Friends, that was Nikki Salvatico, the president of the local Great Valley School District Teachers Union. Thank you so much for being on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I want to read this comment from Jordan, who emails, kids know not to spread lies. They know not to say bigoted things. I think with cases like these, the kids need to be held responsible. Again, the question to you this hour is, who should be held responsible when kids behave badly online? Should it be parents, tech companies? Should it be the children themselves? You can call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Natasha, I wanted to come back to you and ask, how were these young people, so many of them, so easily able to create so many fake accounts?
Well, that is a really interesting question. You can set up an account on TikTok if you are 13 or older, but we also know that millions of kids go on social media who are younger than 13 and just lie about their age. So first of all, there's no barrier to setting up an account. Second of all, you know, anybody can create any kind of account they like. And if it's not reported, TikTok may not know that it's a fake account. And in this case, teachers reported the accounts to TikTok, but TikTok's system for verifying accounts requires you to show your driver's license or some other official document to prove it's you. And some teachers who reported the accounts felt that their privacy had been violated enough, and they didn't trust or they didn't want to give more data, their driver's license, to TikTok. Mm. So TikTok says, you know, how can we take these down if we don't have official information? On the other hand, many teachers who reported these accounts said they never heard back from TikTok at all. And so right before the story came out, I had a conversation with TikTok. I sent them a list of a number of accounts, and they took down 4 that were remaining that were imposter accounts that used the names and photos of Great Valley teachers. But why should it take a journalist who's about to publish a story to get a social media company to take down these accounts that were incredibly hurtful and in some cases really disparaging and traumatic? And so, I mean, one of the questions is, why don't social media companies have dedicated systems for school districts and educators to report problems? Because this isn't the first time I've had school districts or teachers say, we tried to report this violent video, or we tried to report this harassment, and they don't hear back from social media companies. Mm-hmm. So when you ask about who's accountable, I think one of the questions is, what can social media companies do that is school specific to make it easier for educators who've been harassed or who see that students are harassing other students or threatening other students to report these issues.
Yeah, Natasha, stay with us, but you brought up the idea of accountability. And one of the entities that could hold students accountable is the district itself. And so we're going to bring on the superintendent of the Great Valley School District in Chester County. This is Dr. Daniel Goffredo. Dr. Goffredo, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Happy to be here. Thank you. And hopefully my sound is okay.
You sound great. So I want to ask right here from the jump, when did the district become aware of these accounts and what was the response?
So we first learned of one single account. One of our teachers came to a principal, I believe it was February 28th, came and reported that he had learned of a fictitious account created on TikTok. So this happened at the end of the day. We then, in the subsequent days, we learned of the additional accounts. And at that time, in February into the very early days of March, we totaled 22 teachers who had various accounts depicting them and commenting on them. So upon learning that, our principal, unlike most school issues, investigating the creation of online accounts is a different type of investigation for a school to conduct. It took days. I do give our middle school administrative team a lot of kudos for the hours, days, and even weeks that they put into investigating, trying to uncover who the perpetrators were. After a few days, learning that it was, in fact, middle school students, we reached out to our community. We made sure our parents were aware. We held an assembly with our eighth grade students to inform them. We were able to reach out. The Attorney General's office was a great resource. They came in and did both a presentation for our parents and our students to help educate. And also we had a lot of just listening sessions with our staff. I have to say the impact and the hurt, and I use the word wounded, the wounds that really were inflicted on our hardworking staff, it was hard. And so we engaged in some brainstorming. Staff gave me ideas, suggestions. One thing they asked for pretty early was, can you please take our photos down, our directory photos off of the district website, which we honored that request. And so we have some other suggestions. And as we continue to work through the spring and into the summer months, we have some things that we're working on that we hope to implement at the beginning of next school year. And I'm happy as we continue our dialogue to maybe shed a little light on what we're working on this summer.
And quick question, follow-up to Avi's question, Superintendent, is what happened to the young people who were responsible for these accounts? What penalty or punishment did they suffer?
Yeah, I wish I could elaborate on that. I know I heard the prior question about consequences with students. Due to confidentiality reasons, I'm really not at liberty to share anything that we engage with students or their families when it comes to conduct or discipline. I can say, however, that we did hold students accountable. We did investigate. We did uncover some of the creators of the accounts. And we also included a restorative piece where there is a learning component too, and a reflection on the behavior and its impact. And I think that's really critical here is I see a twofold approach. One is you have to hold children accountable. Absolutely. I'm a former teacher, a high school principal. Now I've been a superintendent. I understand the need to hold children accountable and to have compliance. But we also need, and I heard Ms. Silvatico elaborate on this, and I agree wholeheartedly, is that we also need to educate. We need to continue to teach children right from wrong. As much as this deals with technology, it also just deals with common decency and being a good human and being empathetic and understanding that our actions can have profound injuries. And so we need to continue that work and expand that dialogue here in our community.
I want to read this email now from Jennifer, who says, I've been a middle school teacher in Montgomery County for 21 years. It seems parents and the media are uninformed about the dangers of these platforms. As teachers, we have been expressing concerns for years about both social media and cell phone usage. Students have become more cruel, and I have witnessed a rise in racist and homophobic comments. It's clear to me parents are unaware of the power these platforms hold. We only have about a minute, but do you agree with that, Dr. Goffredo? Do you think that teachers have been sounding the alarm and that we have been slow to respond?
I definitely view this as a societal issue. I can't disagree that I think there is a huge propensity to misuse social media. And so as I look at it more broadly, it really is societal. And what I see with children many times is they mirror the behavior that they see from adults. And I think we all need to look inward and say, are we really modeling the proper behaviors for children? Are we having the right discussions? And as a school district, one of our values is being able to engage family, community, parents, and schools in this dialogue. We can absolutely do more to inform parents of their children's online behavior and also help students better comprehend how hurtful their actions can be. So yeah, certainly there is a lot of truth in that statement.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to talk about this. That's Dr. Daniel Goffredo, superintendent of the Great Valley School District in Chester County. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
Yes, and we'll be right back after this short break with more on the fallout from the Great Valley Middle School fake teacher TikTok account. Who do you think is responsible? Is social media making young people less empathetic? You can call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are continuing our conversation now about these fake teacher TikTok accounts at Great Valley Middle School in Chester County and the impact it had on the teachers and the community. We're asking our listeners this hour who should be held responsible for this. You know, some states are regulating kids' access to social media. Some districts are doing cell phone bans in school. Might that have helped? Give us a call, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And right now we're going to go to a caller. We have Barb, a teacher from New Jersey, who wants to talk about who should be held responsible. Barb, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm really tired of parents expecting school districts to do their job. This 100% starts at home. And you wonder why there is a teacher shortage. I find that absolutely baffling. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Barb. Again, a teacher from New Jersey. Want to hear? We have another caller.
Another teacher, actually. Yeah. This is Dan from Berks County, I believe, who wants to talk about the responsibility that tech companies share. Dan, you're on Studio 2.
Well, I definitely agree with the previous caller, too. I think parents need to invest and buy cell phones that do not have the ability to download apps. Mm-hmm. I know that they exist. And kids need cell phones. But kids are going to be kids. They've always been kids, and they have access to this stuff, and it's going to be a problem. But I also do think the regulations that you're kind of speaking about regarding states, and I know that they're talking about something at the federal level in regards to verifying age limits, and cell phones are addicting, and it's purposely addicting. Social media companies need to be held more liable, and they need to be.
That's a fascinating comment from Dan, who is a fellow teacher. And so that's a perfect segue now to bring in a new guest, who is Francis Jensen, neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who studies young brains, how they develop, the interaction with social media. Francis Jensen, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate the lively and really timely discussion. I, as you know, have been looking into this for the last decade or so as to the fascinating new neuroscience that exists around the teenage brain. This is an amazing amount of new work that's been done. And it really shows us that they are not adults with fewer miles on them. They are definitely functioning with a different, you know, set of strengths and a different set of weaknesses than adults. Important to this conversation is that they are really working primarily, their social brain is the part of the brain that's developing. The brain develops from the back to the front. And in mid-teens, it's the social brain, which is sort of in the middle of your brain, behind your ears, so to speak, around that level, not all the way to the front, that is really under intense development. They are looking for social interactions. It's like novelty seeking. They don't have access to their frontal lobes to the extent that we do, because the pathways are not fast enough yet between the frontal lobes. And so the frontal lobes are judgment, risk assessment, impulse control, decision-making, executive functions. They just don't, they're not on board in that way. They are very much driven by their social brains. And in fact, new research is showing that it's the very same part of their social brains that is activated by interpersonal connectivity as is happening with social media. It lights up the same parts of your brain when we do functional imaging. So it's a real effect. And we know how much this group is driven by peer pressure. This is one of their relative weaknesses, but they have incredible strengths as well in that they're able to learn things really fast and they pick up skills really quickly. But this is one of their weaknesses.
Mm. And so, Frances, let me ask you this question. I mean, kids have been pranking teachers for generations. We've done story on middle school behavior. Digital nature of this harassment aside, is this type of behavior fairly normal given the growth or the stage of brain development here? Or is this more egregious, you know, type of behavior? Or is this something we should they're prone to just because of their age?
So they are definitely prone to this just because of their age. In, you know, latter days, this might have been a little post-it note on a bulletin board that somebody could
have pulled up. A whoopee cushion under the seat, that type of thing.
Exactly. Except for now, it can go viral globally fast. So it's really they are, you know, playing with fire, if you will. The environment that we have provided that they can interact with now, we know they are risk-taking beings. This is normal biology playing itself out. We should anticipate this as the adults around them. And I would say that this level of, testing the limits, risk-taking, this is typical of this part of the part of development. Their parts of their brain, such as the nucleus accumbens, which is the part that is really much involved in reward-seeking behavior, is really functioning at a very high level, higher level than in adulthood. Mm. So when you look at when teenagers are given risks or kind of risk-taking games to play, that part of their brain lights up far more than the adult. Why is that? The adult has a frontal lobe that sends back signals to dampen down that. And we go, you know, maybe we shouldn't do that. Bad
idea, don't
do that.
The guardrails, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you.
The brakes.
And I want to leave some time to get back to Natasha Singer from the New York Times. But I want to ask you at least one more question. And it's inspired by this comment from Adrian, who says, unfortunately, parents often protect their kids from consequences well into adulthood, leading to problems in making simple life choices by holding kids responsible for their actions. They learn and grow. Is that the way to deal with it? Is it carrot and stick, or will that simply encourage young people to push the limits further? I really feel like a lot of us come to this crossroads where we see behavior that's clearly unacceptable, but we worry that the punishment will only further encourage the behavior because of all the developmental stuff that you're describing.
And the world we live in.
Yeah.
Like a punishment now will be on the record on the internet for the rest of their life. Mm. It's not like slap your hand, put it back in the closet, you learned your lesson. Mm. We have to figure out a way to allow teenagers to make mistakes in a safe way. What is happening right now is not that different. It's just a different set of tools that they are interacting with, right? And they are far more profoundly consequential, unfortunately.
Right.
So I think of this with empathy for this group. I think of it with wonder that they can learn so much. They are learning so much on, you know, using social media. They are so much more adept as we are. So that's their secret power. But they also it's predictable the mistakes that are being made right now. And you mentioned addiction when I was just coming on. I would just like to point out that that risk reward part of your brain that I've been talking about is also the one that's involved in addiction. And addiction is simply like they can learn better because their brains where they form, you know, synapses between brain cells called neurons. That's how you learn. They can make stronger synapses with very little practice, like adults. We can learn, but it takes us a lot more. Nature has built all of those building blocks at a higher level for childhood and teen years. Unfortunately, that is the same for addiction. Addiction is actually simply a form of learning, but it's happening in that risk reward, you know, addiction circuit. So they can get they can more rapidly get addicted to things, both drugs and things like internet gaming disorder, things like that. And we see that it's really the same part of the brain that is being activated.
So is the answer prohibition, do you think? Or you said approach with empathy. I mean, what does that mean?
I don't think prohibition is a realistic option these days. I think what we have to do is, last I checked, we are the adults in the room, and we have our frontal lobes, and they are connected. And so I always say we should be thinking about more how we can give frontal lobe assists to our younger, community members, these adolescents, and maybe thinking about giving them, they learn very well. So I know when there are really great curriculums in schools talking about how to manage these kinds of risks, to anticipate, what might go on online, how to put cyberbullying back into perspective. They learn these things. Yeah. They can explicitly learn things. But in the moment, because their frontal lobes are not connected in the way as fast as the way ours are, they're not going to, in a split second, go, oh, that's just a stupid thing. That person didn't really mean it about me. They're going to go, oh, my God, my world is falling apart, right?
Yeah.
And it's up to us to sort of explain to them, this is the first generation that has had this amount of knowledge about where the biology of their brains. And that's why I wrote this book called The Teenage Brain a few years ago. I'm working to update it even. It's just having that knowledge available to them, telling them to, to take advantage of this knowledge that we have about their strengths and weaknesses is the best time in your life to improve on your weaknesses. And it's also the time to really hone your strengths. And we should be talking about that more in schools and homes. And again, this idea of trial and error, how to create safe environments for them to make it.
And I want to just jump in here and just read this email from Marianne, who says, students reflect their society. We are in a period where lying and insults and intolerance are modeled and rewarded. And we only have a couple more minutes, and I'm hoping we can squeeze this final caller in. Elizabeth, a Great Valley parent who talks about the pandemic shaping their online. Bring Elizabeth in. Elizabeth, you're on Studio 2. Can you just keep it really short? Please tell us your question or comment.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I definitely agree that the parents need to take a stronger stance in all of this. But I would also point out that this is the pandemic generation, and so much of their early exposure was kind of without oversight because maybe parents or people in their lives were working full time.
That's really important to bring up. And it goes back to that empathy point that Frances Jensen was mentioning. Natasha Singer from the New York Times, you've been so patient.
Yes, thank you.
Let's wrap it up for everybody, because we have a lot of emailers saying we need legislation. We need to hold TikTok accountable. We need people to be arrested for this. I mean, what are the solutions that are realistically on the table from a policy perspective, Natasha Singer?
Well, Congress has a bill, the Kids Online Safety Act, that would put restrictions on social media. But honestly, I just think we have to think about it from a much bigger perspective, which is we've been teaching something in schools for 100 years about how to use thrilling, powerful machines and not harm people, and it's called driver's ed. And that involves parents and learner's permits, as well as school education, and we teach kids how to use cars safely so they don't get hurt and nobody else gets hurt. And everybody,
I will just chime in that I agree with you 100%. They need to be explicitly told about, like, the strengths and, the risks and benefits of social media.
Yeah, and that was Frances Jensen, Natasha Singer.
Like, we have digital citizenship, and it has failed, because if it had worked, we wouldn't see what happened in Great Valley. So I think that driver's ed is a more comprehensive model where everybody is a stakeholder. So that's what I think.
So before you can get access to a phone, you need to take some digital citizenship class, and parents should be responsible for that.
A driver's test for social media.
Parents should sign your learner's permit for your phone.
Wow. Interesting. I had not heard of that potential solution before.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we ended with a solution. We do have to wrap up this conversation. Sammy and Marion and David, thanks for those emails. I'm sorry we couldn't get to you. We tried to squeeze as much as we could in this 1 hour, but I'm sure we will revisit this topic in the future. Let me thank you, Natasha Singer, New York Times technology reporter, for breaking this story and for joining us today. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you for having me.
And Frances Jensen, neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you for all of your perspective on how young brains are developing.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you to all our callers for today. We appreciate you. And this wraps up our show. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Kevin McCrory is the executive producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. And from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.